getting back up in an airplane, why people are scared to go to the hospital, and a relaxing activity for your long weekend. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Air travel has dropped by 90% since mid-March. As Florida slowly reopens, we're likely to see more traffic at the airports. But when will you feel confident in flying again? We're going to talk about the future of the airline industry with the head of MIA. Plus, Broward County health officials have noticed a disturbing trend. The number of people dying at home has gone up by a lot. Many of these people could have been treated. How is coronavirus scaring people from hospitals where they could be saved? Finally,
you start letting the rest of your problems kind of fall away. It's kind of a form of meditation, which is nice.
Some of the final migrations of birds are taking place this month. Why the pandemic might be a reason to pick up a hobby like bird watching. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you live near an airport, you probably notice that the sky seems a lot less busy and a little quieter. There are fewer planes. The airline industry has been hit hard by the pandemic. Now, there have been severe restrictions on travel across the globe, and Florida was on lockdown for weeks. South Florida is just barely reopening. We are entering a new normal, but really the question is, when are you going to feel confident getting back on a plane? We're joined now by Miami International Airport CEO and Director, Lester Sola. Mr. Sola, thanks for your time today.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
So now that Miami-Dade and some of the cities within the county have reopened under very strict guidelines, what's changed this past week at MIA?
So what we've been noticing is that little by little, air travel volumes are increasing, right? It's still significantly lower than what it was just a few months ago. I'll give you as an example. On a day like today, about 115,000 to 120,000 passengers would have come through MIA. And what we're expecting today is 10,000 passengers. So still a significant reduction, albeit a little higher than the all-time low, which was at one point we processed only 3,000 passengers. So, like, I mean, my estimation is this is going to be a slow upward climb, as you mentioned. How's the confidence increasing amongst our travelers?
Who's traveling right now? Who are these people coming through the airport?
Well, air travel is still going to be an essential form of travel. I mean, there's individuals that still have to either travel for business or for family. So those are the kind of mandatory travels that we're seeing that people that are booking flights. The airlines have also reduced significantly their rates to entice some passengers to travel. So we still suspect that a significant amount of leisure travel is not being used, as well as some of the business travel with the onset of Zoom and Citrix and WebEx and all these other opportunities to still be able to transact your business with a face-to-face telecommunications.
And do we have a sense of where people are coming from? I mean, is it mostly national? I mean, people coming from around the country, international, or do we know where people are coming from?
Historically, our travel has been 50-50, 50% domestic travel and 50% international travel. We are the gateways to the Americas and the Caribbean. The significant reductions in travels into South America, we probably have two flights maybe a day. So the majority of the travel that's taking place is, in fact, domestic travel within the U.S.
So when I went on the flight information dashboard on the website, I noticed almost half or a very big chunk of flights are canceled. Were those canceled already, or are these cancellations being made daily?
No. So what happens is that the airlines, for the most part, established their schedules a month in advance. So those travels or those airline flights have already been canceled for quite some time. It's just that they remain on the schedule because they're regularly scheduled flights. So what the airline does is updates on a weekly basis. So we leave them on the screen because it's part of the regular schedule, but they're just not being operated at this time. So, for example, an American Airlines, if I could use obviously our largest carrier here, will establish the June schedule early on in May. So it's usually a month in advance, if not a month and a half, is when you start seeing what the airline industry is expecting to forecast as far as air travel in the imminent future.
How about people leaving the area? Do we have a lot of folks who are traveling from here going somewhere else?
What happened early on during the pandemic in the month of March, I would say, there was a significant amount of travel still international and domestic. People will go either going home or coming. So if you were a U.S. citizen and you were abroad, there was a significant amount of travel for those individuals that were either in the European markets or in the South American markets or the Caribbean coming back home. Just vice versa, the same thing was happening. So a lot of Latin Americans were trying to head back home. So you saw an incredible amount of travel with really sizable bookings, but for the most part, it's people just going back to their homes.
If I recall, going back to even the early, mid-March, early April, that airlines were told they still had to fly planes. But when it comes to stimulus money, they still had to fly planes. But why were airlines canceling flights? Was it because they didn't have enough people or any people at all?
Well, it's interesting. That's an interesting situation. As part of the aid package that the airlines received, and it's completely separate than the aid package that the airports received, the airline industry, the federal government wanted to ensure that all of the airports remained open and that every city that was receiving regularly scheduled flights was still receiving some type of flights. They wanted to maintain the connectivity. So there was a focus on airlines maintaining the flights, albeit there were a lot of negotiations going back and forth. There were four airlines offering flights to that one city that maybe only one airline will remain offering service to that city. But another component of that, which is oftentimes, it's taken for granted, and it's very, very important here at Miami International Airport, is that a significant component of cargo is actually arriving in the bellies of passenger airplanes. Oftentimes we think that cargo airlines are just moving cargo and passenger airlines are just moving passengers and their luggage, but that's not the case. A significant amount of travel into the South American market, into the Caribbean market, and even the European market is actually, the profitability of that flight is maintained as a result of the merchandise, the cargo that's in the belly of that plane.
And the cargo right now, what is that cargo? Are airlines turning their passenger planes into like freight planes?
So we've actually seen some flights that will fly for the most part almost empty because it's full of, the belly of the plane is full of cargo. So cargo is actually up at Miami International Airport. For the month of April, we were 15 to 17%. And just for the month of May so far, we're 25% up. So what that tells you is that the products still have to move. So especially now with a lot of, we're one of the certified pharmaceutical airports. So an incredible amount of pharmaceuticals, PPE, so everything that dealing with not just day-to-day healthcare and medicines, but also dealing with this pandemic, those supplies are coming through MIA.
Okay, so as things start to reopen, we're going to have the risk for a while because it's going to be a while before we have any kind of antiviral or vaccine. But as the country starts to reopen, what would you like to see happen with the airlines?
So I think it's important that we empower the individuals, and I think Mayor Jimenez and the Board of County Commissioners have been instrumental in their messaging and saying you need to act as if everyone can be infected, right? So then that tells you that you as a human being, you as a traveler, you as somebody within this community, you have to protect yourself and you have to protect others as well too. So when you come to the airport, whether you're a visitor or you're a traveler, you're going to see significant amount of messaging, lots of signage telling you to maintain your 6 feet distance, social distance. You're going to see a significant increase in the number of disinfectant stations throughout the airport. You're going to see plexiglass. You're going to see social distancing markings throughout the entire airport. And as long as we have the capacity to provide that, we're going to be enforcing that. So that sends the message to everyone who comes to the airport, whether you're an employee or whether you're a traveler, that there's an expectation that you conform to the rules, not just to protect you, but to protect yourself. And I believe that as people will continuously see the behavior of their fellow passengers, the airline's enforcement of masks, you're gonna have that confidence go up, and people will continue to ultimately fly as they had before.
Well, that's the interesting part is you talk about confidence. It's about having the consumer confidence. And there was a poll from the Democracy Fund in UCLA, and it showed 60% of people will definitely or probably wait to fly, even if restrictions are lifted. That's not a lot of confidence.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it evolves. It's the majority of the flights tend to be two and a half to 3 hour flights, right? Obviously, if you're going international, a significantly longer flight. But there are steps that you can take to protect yourself and to protect your fellow passengers. The airlines are taking aggressive steps as well too. They're trying not to fill the planes beyond 60%. So the ultimate indicator is going to be, like you mentioned, are people going to feel confident? Are they going to feel safe? And are they going to have the confidence in the government to maintain the areas clean? That are there going to be protocols going to be enhanced and enforced? So as people see how the industry evolved, and we have to also remember that this industry evolved after September 11th. There was a certain level of security pre 9/11, and post 9/11,
everything changed,
and we had to go through those pains, if you will, to ultimately get to the point that we had improved the TSA checkpoints, the online boarding. And so this pandemic will cause yet another shift of how the industry is going to have to adapt. And the airline industry has been around decades, hundreds of years, centuries, and I am certain that they will adapt proportionally make sure to address this.
You talk about what the airport is doing to create that security, mm-hmm. but I wonder what the airlines are doing. Look, I've seen and heard stories of airplanes that are almost empty, but then there have been stories of airplanes that looked pretty packed. So, I mean, are the airlines doing enough to keep that social distancing and keep people safe?
Yeah, I've seen those stories as well, too. The predominant number of flights, the airlines do have a policy of not selling the middle seat.
Do they cap it at, what, 60%?
60%. That has been now. The issue has been is that sometimes there have been so many sell in. I don't want to speak for the airlines, but there have been instances where people. I've seen the social media pictures where the airline has not been able to maintain that middle seat. Right. So, and I won't speak for them, but I will tell you that their policy has been to not sell the middle seat. It'd be every night before the planes are basically put back into service for the next day. High level disinfection. They're actually fogging the planes with this disinfectant. And then what we are traditionally used to seeing when an airplane arrives at a destination and a crew goes in and just basically picks up the garbage and cleans up, they're actually increasing the type of cleaning of an airplane. So, but that's only going to go so far. Ultimately, it's going to be on you as the individual to also take steps to protect yourself. They're allowing you to bring in bottles of disinfectant, so you can take steps to ensure your safety as you're flying through MIA or any airport in the U.S.
And I mean, look, it's been a little while since I've been on an airplane, but as I recall, it felt like it's been getting tighter and tighter in airplanes. Seats are getting a lot smaller, and even a row that's not 6 feet. I mean, is that enough? Is that enough to protect people? Those are even a big plane. You're in a small space with people.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. It's going to be, again, this is going to be a situation that the airline industry is going to have to adapt. We haven't developed what the norms are going to be, what the rules are going to be. In fact, there's still discussions in Washington D.C. as to what is going to be the screening protocol for passengers coming to an airport. Is it going to be temperatures? Is it going to be something else? So we are evolving, right? But while we're still operating as an airport, and it's important that we maintain airports open, because it's not just people that we're moving. We're also moving a significant amount, like I mentioned, cargo. But we are evolving as we are going to evolve after every situation that impacts the industry.
We're talking with Miami International Airport CEO and Director Lester Sola. You can share your thoughts or questions on social media at WLRN Sundial. What do you want to see done to make airports and airplanes safer? And when are you going to feel confident in flying again? We'd like to hear your thoughts on that. So, Mr. Sola, let's talk about what's going to change, because you mentioned it. You know, after 9/11, TSA, Homeland Security, we had a lot of changes. You already mentioned some of the things the airports are doing, but what's the big change you think is going to come, that may be permanent?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if we get to the point that we're doing point of origin testing. And that's really been the big sticking point as to what kind of testing are we going to do. If we're unable to control this virus, what are we going to do to the flying public and the visitors, not just in airports, but really anywhere that's going to be a form of travel? So as we know, yes, you can take in, there's some areas that are taking temperatures, but you may be asymptomatic. So taking a temperature may not be enough, right? Well, hence, back to the statement of you have to take measures to protect yourself and others, regardless of where you are. So TSA, the FAA, and the airline industry, as well as the airport groups, are in conversations with D.C., the Washington, D.C., to see what is a protocol that we can announce, that we can carry out, that will still deliver, that will deliver not just a message, but also a true indication of the safety of the flying public. So that continues to evolve.
You talk about, those temperature checks. I mean, look, I had read possibilities are, that you would arrive, they would have to do the temperature checks, that basically the walkway to the airplane, they are sanitizing you and your luggage. And then, after you get off the plane, it's another check. So it's a lot of layers that you may have to add.
I will tell you that's not so far off. And I'll give you an example with biometrics. There are certain arrival gates at MIA today when you're coming from an international flight. And you end up before a customs officer, whether a U.S. citizen, a resident, or a foreigner. But unbeknownst to the traveling public, before every single flight that is leaving from an international destination, Customs and Border Protection is vetting every passenger. And ultimately, when you land at your airport, whether it be MIA or another airport, Customs and Border Patrol may be using, in combination with Miami International Airport, may be using biometric information to pre-screen you as you're coming off that plane. So by the time you end up before the customs officer with biometric information, you've already been confirmed that you are, in fact, the individual that's standing before the officer. So including biometrics, or some type of a health screening, is a possibility that may ultimately be deployed.
So, I just think about, again, you're adding these different layers for safety, and that means more time. And so we're telling people show up to the airport 2 hours early, and it could be 3 or 4 hours early, and the process of taking a flight could be that much longer. Isn't that going to scare some people off?
It could, but it just like we learned and adapted after 9/11, when there were 2 hours and 3 hour wait check-ins to go through TSA, the industry continues to evolve, and it's gotten to the point that we've always told people to be here 2 hours before and 3 hours before for international. You actually see the throughput at some of these TSA checkpoints now less than 10 minutes, right, with TSA pre. So there's things that we can continue to do that once we adopt what the protocol and the standard is going to be, that we believe that we can continue to evolve with technology.
And have we learned anything from airports in, say, in China or parts of Europe where they were hit really hard early by the coronavirus?
I think you have to take this very seriously. And early on, right when it was beginning, we made the decision in consultation with the airline partners that we were going to increase of our janitorial crews. We deployed. We actually were early into the market in buying hand sanitizers. We already had some throughout the airport. We put one at every gate. So we actually had crew going and filling all these hand sanitizers because we knew that there was an opportunity as far as procuring resources that we needed to be aggressive and do that early on. And so what you have to learn is that you have to be cognizant of what a trend is and how are you going to adapt your operation so that you are going to be able to have masks on hand. You are going to be able to have gloves. I mean, these are things that we had even before the pandemic was here in its earnest, in not just in Miami, but in the state and in the country.
Let me move over to airports got a lot of money in the CARES Act. MIA received millions from the CARES Act. Where did those funds go? Was it mostly for these efforts for sanitation and again, social distancing?
So just the CARES Act included $10 billion for airports, and there was a formula by the FAA to distribute those dollars. MIA's share, and when I say MIA, it's really our network of airports, because we have general aviation airports as well, too. Our share was $207 million. And those $207 million allows you to use those dollars to make payroll, to pay your debt service, and other operations, okay? So we have used those dollars, and those dollars are going to be obviously brought in from the CARES Act into our side of the ledger, and we're using those dollars today. There was also a plan of relief, if you will, to the airlines that the airport offered. The airlines, and oftentimes people don't understand that the airlines are basically the backstop. They're the ones that guarantee the bonds that the airports issue for construction. So we offered some deferment of rents, deferments, not waivers, deferments of rents to the airlines to help them get through this issue as well, too. As well as we waived significant of the amount of the payments that the concessionaires had to pay. So we offered a sizable relief into the $60 to $67 million range to all of our business partners. Now, we're lucky that the airport has a very strong financial balance sheet. So we have a significant amount of dollars that are unrestricted as well as some that are restricted. So we can weather this storm, and we have the funds necessary to make the necessary changes to the infrastructure, if that's in fact the case, or the operation. So,
and that's the airport. You could weather this, but what about the airlines? And I mean, you know, I'd heard Boeing CEO last week on the Today Show. He says one of the major airlines is going to go down for this. But I mean, how are the airlines doing?
You know, it's hard to speak for them, but on the surface, I do see where we were on a year like today operating close to 900 different flights out of this airport, and today we're doing about 100, 107, 110, right? That's a significant downturn. I think time will tell what impact to long-term impact and how long is this going to be around. And how the airlines are able to recover. But the industry, whether it has been through mergers, through partnerships, through code-sharing agreements, has always somehow evolved, because there will always be a need to move people quickly, not just nationally, but internationally.
We don't know how long this is going to last. Again, things are starting to reopen a little bit. You're starting to see an uptick in numbers. But what do you see as the new normal for the airport and for the airline industry, at least for the next few years?
I believe that there's going to be an incredible amount of responsibility on the individual traveler. I remember, you know, obviously you have to travel as part of this position, but I'm sure there's people who recall that they've traveled internationally or even here domestically, and every once in a while they would see individuals with masks either at an airport or inside of an airplane. And my wife historically has always traveled with a mask because of a chronic condition. So that may be the norm, and it didn't surprise anyone at that time when you walked through an airport and you saw somebody with a mask, and it shouldn't surprise anyone now. That is a measure, an important measure that people are taking to protect themselves and their fellow travelers.
Lester Sola is the CEO and director of Miami International Airport. Mr. Sola, I really appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the opportunity. All the best.
All right. And again, you know, we want to hear from you. You know, again, what is going to make you feel more confident about flying again? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Maybe you're waiting to get back up there and you want to take some trips. Tell us all about your thoughts and feelings about that. Well, still to come, people are scared of going to the hospital. Should they have reason to be? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The coronavirus pandemic is having a dangerous ripple effect on communities across the country. The number of people dying at home out of fear of going to the hospital has skyrocketed. In April, the Broward County Fire Department responded to double the number of deaths at home compared to the year before. And May is not looking any better. What are hospitals doing to ensure your safety when you're admitted? Dr. Randy Katz is the chairman of emergency services at Memorial Regional Hospital and the medical director of Hollywood Fire Rescue. Dr. Katz, I appreciate your time.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
What have your teams at Memorial Health and at the Hollywood Fire Department seen over the last couple of months when they go out in the field? What have you seen that really troubles you?
Well, I think it's true that the public is paralyzed with fear. Our number of visits to the emergency department have come down significantly. Our volumes in the emergency department are down approximately 40% the past few months. And we're starting to see a slow increase. And the call volume with 911 and fire rescue in the county, both Hollywood and the entire county, down approximately 20%. So what you're seeing is a desire to stay away from 911 centers and hospitals and healthcare centers out of fear. So I think that's pervasive in the community now.
And what have you heard anecdotally, like through the calls to the 911 line, about that fear of going to the hospital?
Well, I could tell you personally, I've received phone calls from friends and family asking me what they should do. They have a loved one who's having chest pain or kidney stones or some other medical ailment and asking me if it's safe to go to the hospital. A lot of people are concerned about not having a family member with them. If a child's sick, you know, can the parent come with the child? You know, a lot of the visitor restrictions have been in place for a few months now, and so people are concerned about that. Those are the types of things that we're hearing. And I can tell you that, as you mentioned earlier, the number of dead on arrival cases across the country, not just Broward County, has gone up significantly. Our call volume as a whole is down, but the number of patients that we call on as a 911 agency, in those cases, we've seen more patients at home dying and people at end stage disease, you know, sort of courses with stroke and heart disease coming in later, missing that crucial time period where we can make a difference with treatment.
And you've been, you know, as you said, this is a nationwide problem. You've had conversations with medical professionals up in New York. What have they seen?
Well, you know, New York is a whole different story. And I could tell you that at one point, the call volume in New York was up about 40-50%, and their DOA volume, their dead on arrival, you know, the number of patients that they would respond to that were already expired went up about 300-400% at one point. Those numbers have since come down, but they're still up 40-50%, and their call volume is actually now down from where it was last year this time. So they've seen a dramatic uptick and then call volume decrease. But the concerning piece is that you do have people that are hesitant to call 911 or come to the emergency department for things like stroke symptoms or chest pain. And these are things that are extremely time sensitive. And there are windows of time to treat patients for these things. And when you lose that time window, you lose a good outcome. And that's what the most concerning thing is. And in addition, you have people dying that unnecessarily are dying right now.
And I wanted to get to that point about the folks who are dying at home. What do we know about what they're dying of? Is it a lot of heart attacks?
Well, it's hard to tell you that because the medical examiner, you know, receives a lot of these cases and they don't test everybody for COVID-19. You know, it's not universally done for a patient that expires in the field. So we don't know how many of these patients actually have COVID-19 or whether these are cardiac events. I don't have a lot of the medical examiner data, you know, to analyze it. So a lot of that data is pretty fresh and it's not really available, you know, publicly. But I could tell you that, you know, overdoses, the number of overdoses have gone up. Substance abuse has become a major issue. And the number of patients we're actually seeing in the ER now for substance abuse and mental health issues has gone up. So there may be a component of overdoses that we're not recognizing yet. There may be people with cardiac symptoms who are ignoring symptoms for, you know, a few days and suffer a heart attack at home. And then there's the COVID-19, you know, crisis and patients that may have COVID-19. And, you know, some of those patients do have complications and do not come to the hospital. So we don't really know what's making up that group of patients as far as the reason for dying. But we know that the numbers are up.
And just so I'm sure then, you know, again, is it that the data is just not available or the medical examiners they're going to have to determine which patients they perform an autopsy on?
Correct. And the medical examiner only has so much bandwidth to perform autopsies. And I know for a fact that they're not testing everybody for COVID-19, only if patients have risk factors or symptoms suggestive of COVID-19. And they don't do a full autopsy on every patient that expires in the field. So a lot of, you know, the causes of death are presumptive causes of death, and many times you just don't get that answer over time.
So we don't know, and that means there could be COVID-19 deaths, but we just don't know.
Correct.
And how does that differ from what you're seeing at the hospital? How much pressure has there been on your intensive care unit?
Well, I could tell you down here in South Florida, I think we were extremely lucky. We did not see the same surge that some of the other places around the world saw, including New York City. So our peak was right around mid-April. We did see a significant drop-off in volume coming to the emergency department around mid-March. But the patients that are coming in tend to be sicker now, patients that are more advanced disease or have ignored chronic medical treatment for a number of weeks and come to the hospital, you know, pretty far in their disease course. So we're seeing sicker patients, patients that, you know, haven't been able to get to their physician. And there's a huge access to care gap. And telemedicine has, I think, filled some of that gap. But patients just don't have access to care. So I think the message to the public, and it's important, is that the hospitals are safe. And if I had to rewind a couple months ago, I probably couldn't say everything was safe. We didn't know what was going on. But the numbers are so low now that we're only admitting one, maybe two patients to the hospital a day that have COVID-19. That's where we're at right now. And that's what the numbers are. So, you know, there's this perception of fear and you know, lack of safety, but the hospitals are safe. And I would venture to say that the hospital right now is safer than the grocery store.
Again, talking with Dr. Randy Katz. He's the chairman of emergency services at Memorial Regional Hospital and the medical director of Hollywood Fire Rescue. Broward County seeing double the number of at-home deaths in April this year compared to last, and the trend looks a little similar in May. Again, as he mentioned, not always all of these patients are getting autopsies, so we don't know the cause of death in many of those cases. All right, so you're saying, Dr. Katz, that the hospital is safer, but you've got to convince people of that. People are afraid, as you said, to call. They're afraid to go. Part of the fear is maybe they'll get infected. The other part is family may be kept, you know, separated, and family members may not be able to be with their loved ones. Which is the bigger fear, and how do you overcome it?
I think the fear of acquiring COVID-19 is probably the biggest fear. You know, the hospital, obviously, you know, we're taking care of sick patients. And I think a lot of the things we saw on TV from New York City and Milan, Italy, have really deeply scarred the public. You know, seeing those images and seeing what was happening in some of these cities. But that's not the case now. And I think when you look at what we're doing as a healthcare system, we're taking measures far and beyond what any other public place is doing in the community. You know, everybody that enters our hospital system, whether it's the emergency department or they're coming in for surgery, they're screened, tested for COVID-19. If they're having surgery or being admitted to the hospital, we test everybody. All of our staff in the emergency department wear protective equipment, you know, masks, gloves, gowns, things like that when they need to. Everybody is really operating at a very high safety level, and it really protects our patients. It protects the staff, and there really is no reason to fear coming to the hospital or the emergency department.
And are COVID patients kept somewhere else?
So anytime a patient comes in with concerning symptoms, you know, either by history or x-ray findings, all of those patients are cohorted and kept in a separate area upstairs in our ICU. You had asked about the ICU. Our numbers are down about half of where they were, you know, from, let's say, a month and a half ago. And those patients are kept in a separate unit with a separate ventilation system, designated staff that are taking care of only those patients who are trained in taking care of those patients. And those are the only patients they take care of. So everybody is really segregated and separated so that there are no risks to the general population in our hospital here for regular medical issues.
The governor, of course, not too long ago said, you know what, hospitals can start looking at, you know, elective procedures. This was a big challenge for hospitals, is they needed to expand, get back to helping other patients in other ways. But have you begun to see more people coming in for other things?
Yes, we started doing elective surgeries last week, and we're seeing a slow increase, you know, gradually. This week is busier than last week. And I think, you know, what I think is important to understand is that the collateral damage in healthcare from COVID-19 is significant. People have not accessed care for 2 months. You know, people have not received screening tests. Surgeries that were scheduled were not done. People did not take their medication for a month because they couldn't get to their doctor to get a prescription filled. And what we're realizing is that a lot of those things are not going to be really seen in data until months or even years from now. These are things that may take months to really visualize, you know, the impact it's having. But we are seeing increasing elective cases coming through, patients coming in that would typically come to the ER. And when they get here, they realize it's safe, it's not crowded. they can be taken care of effectively. So I think more and more patients are realizing that, and as they come to the ER and they come to the hospital for surgery, they're realizing how safe it is.
There have been a lot of questions about the data that's being collected by the Florida Department of Health with regards to coronavirus testing and deaths and illness. Your hospital is equipped with coronavirus tests, but first I want to start with this. Can you give me the difference between the antibody test and the diagnostic test?
Sure. So, whenever you acquire a virus or you're exposed to a virus, your body develops an immune response, and that is basically antibodies that are produced. So these are small, little proteins in your body that fight the virus, and we call these IgG or IgM antibodies. When you go somewhere to check for antibodies, you're basically trying to decide whether or not the person being tested had exposure to the virus. And whether you produce antibodies or not is unclear at this point. It seems that some people have a fairly robust antibody response, and some people have a very weak antibody response. But the antibodies are really indirect, and it's not telling you whether you actually have an infection. It's just telling you whether you've been exposed to a virus. The other test is called a PCR test, which is basically taking a genetic piece of that virus and swabbing the surface of the nose or the back of the throat and seeing if that virus exists in your body. And that's a diagnostic test, and that tells you whether you actually have the virus. Some of the difficulties with that test is that what we're seeing are patients are testing positive for long periods of time. Sometimes we can have a patient that tests positive with a nasal swab for 3 weeks, they test negative for a week, and then they test positive again a week later. Nobody quite understands why that's happening, but those tests are designed to really detect whether somebody actually has the virus.
And to be cleared of it, you have to have two negative tests, right?
Correct. So anytime we clear somebody to come to work, come back to work, whether it's a healthcare provider or an EMS provider, they have two tests at least 24 hours apart to confirm negativity. And that's why we do two tests, because sometimes some of the viral load or the amount of virus being released from the body can be very low and be very hard to detect one day. And the next day it could be a little higher, or the sample can be taken a different way. So we do take all precautions whenever we let somebody come back to work. We always test them twice, 24 hours apart.
And you talk about the difference between the antibody test and the diagnostic test. As a healthcare professional, which test result provides you with the most useful information?
I think it's a combination of the two, to be honest with you. If you're sick and you have symptoms, the PCR nasal swab or oral swab is definitely your best test. That test is going to tell you whether you actually have the virus. So anybody that's symptomatic should have a PCR test done. The antibodies are really more for surveillance and epidemiology and looking at communities to decide, okay, how many people in this community have been exposed to the virus, but they're not meant to be diagnostic tests. And I think the public needs to also understand some of these places around Dade and Broward County offering antibody testing to make a diagnosis. Be very wary of those places because these are not diagnostic tests and they don't tell you anything about a diagnosis. They may or may not tell you whether you've been exposed, and that's about it.
Another key piece of data that's being reported by the Florida Department of Health, the number of patients presenting influenza-like symptoms. Do you have an understanding of how that information is being reported to the DOH?
So anytime, the DOH does track chief complaints. So we have systems in place that are electronic systems that track chief complaints. So anybody with flu-like symptoms that comes into the ER, it goes into a database and they have surveillance on these complaints. And we've seen a dramatic drop in influenza-like illness. Usually around this time of year, we do see a drop, through the summer, but we've seen it really drop down almost to zero. And I think a lot of that is because people have been staying away from the hospital for minor complaints, from the emergency room. If they have cold-like symptoms or flu-like symptoms, they may go to a testing center, but they're staying away from the emergency department if they're fairly well.
And the data on coronavirus deaths, this all comes down to whether there's an autopsy, right?
Sure. I mean, every patient that expires, has to be tested to get a true measure of whether these patients actually had COVID-19. And what we know is COVID-19 is affecting all organ systems in the body. It affects the heart, the kidneys, the lungs. It is a systemic illness. And many of these patients have cardiac complications. We have patients that have been on dialysis because of COVID-19. Obviously, the lung issues and the pneumonia we all know about. So we don't know, sometimes a patient can arrest in the field, have a cardiac arrest event. It seems like a cardiac event. And if you don't test for COVID-19, there's no way to know whether it was related to an infection. And without testing these people, we just don't know the answer.
You know, and you look at all the different data points that politicians are trying to use to figure out how to reopen the economy. But what's your biggest concern about the information that we're collecting, you know, not just in the state of Florida, but, you know, nationally? You know, what do you want to see more of, or what can we be doing better?
Well, I think, you know, the state of Florida has done a pretty good job with data, to be honest with you. We look at various different data points. And, you know, one of the important metrics is hospital admissions, because what happens in the community when you increase testing capacity, when you start testing thousands of people, the number of people that are positive, it's going to go down regardless of the same number of people infected. So, for instance, if 10 people have infection in the community and I test 100, that's a 10% infection rate. But if I test 200, it's 5%. But it's the same 10 people that are infected. So sometimes when you increase testing capacity, you open up testing centers, you do more testing, you may see percentages come down, but that doesn't mean there's less people infected. I think a good measure to really pay attention to is hospital admissions for COVID-19. And we're seeing that number come down dramatically. Again, we're seeing maybe one or two patients admitted to the hospital a day. And we do test other patients that we send home. And maybe two or three of those patients are positive. So a handful of patients at a large, busy hospital is a very small number of patients. Percentage-wise, we're talking single digits, 1%. But the other thing, too, I would mention, too, about employees, we do surveillance testing on employees. And essentially, less than 1% of employees in our healthcare system have had any type of reaction or test result that was positive. And we don't see any of that in our employee staff at all in the hospital.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you said that we should be looking at the hospitalization. So that's the politicians are saying that. But let's go back to the very beginning of this conversation. There are a lot of people who don't want to go to the hospital. So how can we trust that number? How can we trust that information?
Well, you know, it's a valid point. My gut feeling, and just looking at the numbers of people that are dying at home, these are small numbers, although the percentages are up. Just to give you an example, the city of Fort Lauderdale, they usually see about 25 patients a month that are dead on arrival. In the month of April, they saw about 50. So they're still small numbers. I don't think those numbers are large enough to really, you know, indicate that people aren't coming and they're dying at home from COVID-19. But there's clearly patients that have mild symptoms or even potentially asymptomatic that have had the virus. And that's where the community testing is really important. So, you know, looking at percentage rate or penetrance in the community is important. And marrying that to hospital visits is also important. I think you have to look at all of the data. And unfortunately, there's been so much data thrown at us that we almost have to have degrees in statistics in order to figure out what's going on, because there's just a lot of data out there. So I think those are the two things, you know, the percent of patients we're testing in the community that are positive and the number of patients or the percent of patients coming into the hospital that are being admitted for COVID-19. If you look at those two metrics, both of those are down dramatically, which means to me that the number of patients in the community with this infection has gone down dramatically as well.
So as we start to reopen everything up and trying to move into the summer and looking at the fall, you know, we're talking about schools getting back. What's your biggest concern about a possible second spike?
Well, I think that most likely we'll continue to see virus out there in the community. It'll probably be at very low levels through the summer. You know, we'll probably see pockets of increase, you know, in certain areas of the country and maybe in certain communities where maybe a group event occurred or something like that. I don't think the virus is going to go away, but I do think, you know, people need to understand that we still have to live our life. We still have to access healthcare. We still have to go to work and provide income for our family, but we can do it safely and we have to do it a different way now. We have to wear a mask when we're in public. We have to mind space between, you know, other people in public places. You know, restaurants have to operate a certain way, you know, to succeed. And I think everybody really has to work together as a community and understand that if we don't have socially responsible people in our community, we're going to have problems. And people have to obey some of these things that we're going to need to do in order to get through this. But we'll get through it. I don't think we're going to see a huge spike like we did early on. I think if anything, maybe, you know, some bumps in the road, and maybe in the winter we see a little more of a bump. But ultimately, it's going to be around, and we have to learn to live with it, and we have to change the way we live our life a little bit.
Dr. Randy Katz is the chairman of emergency services at Memorial Regional Hospital, also the medical director of Hollywood Fire Rescue. Dr. Katz, I really appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Well, still to come, Being stuck at home during the pandemic means you could pick up some new hobbies. I got one for you. Bird watching. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Outdoor activities have made a comeback. I mean, since stay-at-home orders began in South Florida, people have counted on the outdoors for relief. There's more bike riding and a greater appreciation of just being outside. And one of those activities people are enjoying, bird watching. Maybe you've noticed more birds around. Have you gotten into bird watching? We spoke with Mark Edden recently. He is the executive director of the Florida Keys Audubon Society, and he told us about some of the birds that you can watch around your backyard this time of year. How do you describe your passion for bird watching to somebody who's never done it before?
I guess it's a curiosity. There's a certain urge to put a name to things, and seeing birds and not knowing what they are kind of drives you crazy once you get to a certain point. So you're just basically trying to put a name to a thing. And, you know, there's about probably 120 species of birds you could possibly see in the Keys. So it's always a way to stay entertained.
You know, I've heard people say that because of the coronavirus pandemic, that nature has kind of come out a lot more. And we've seen obviously fewer planes in the sky. So now there are more birds. Is it true?
Well, no, not really. This goes on every year, all the time. You know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of birds fly over Florida every spring. And it's, you know, birds that are down south and they're coming north. And so I think people are just living slower lives right now, so they're more attuned to it. And, you know, maybe it's different with mammals, like raccoons and such, but birds are living this life all the time. This is just something that people are kind of tuning in this year to, because I think they've got a little more downtime.
So what do we see this time of year usually with migrations? What's coming through the area?
Migration in Florida lasts about a month, starts usually to get serious around mid-April, and it kind of goes till mid-May. And so you're seeing what you're seeing are songbirds, a lot of songbirds. And, you know, you can actually see it on the weather radar. You can see them about 45 minutes after sunset. They kind of rise up as a cloud of birds from Cuba, and they fly across the Florida Straits. And, you know, when they get to the Keys, if it's bad weather, they'll come down. If it's good weather, a lot of times they'll just keep going. So we're always getting some birds from this in the Keys. But a lot of times they'll go all the way up to the mainland. So they'll, you know, go up by you guys like Matheson Hammock and places like that in the Deering Estate.
If somebody's never done this before, what do you tell them? How do you start? What kind of data am I collecting? If we were to go out there, obviously having to keep a little social distance, what would you teach me about what exactly bird watching is?
Well, bird watching is just going out and kind of getting kind of quiet and tuning into the things you normally tune out, if that makes sense. You know, birds kind of are with us almost all the time. Even, you know, when migration's over, we're going to have a lot of bird species in Florida that are breeding, that are living. You know, they're going to be here. You know, they're here all the time. So it's pretty, you know, easy thing to tune into. And you just kind of have to go out and, you know, stare into bushes and walk around and listen to things you don't necessarily recognize until you do recognize them, and kind of learn how to look at a bird. And, you know, the people who can help with this always are, you know, your local Audubon chapters, Tropical Audubon up in Miami, and, you know, Everglades Audubon operating out of Broward, and, you know, Florida Keys Audubon. That's kind of what we try to do, is to introduce people to nature. We try to act as ambassadors for wildlife.
And that information, how is it helping research right now?
Well, I mean, the easiest place, you know, every year there's a thing called the Christmas Bird Count that's been going on for, I believe, about 120 years. So that's, you know, the biggest citizen science project in the country, in the world, I think. But there's also this new thing in the last probably 10 or 15 years. I don't know its exact start date, but there's a thing called eBird, where people go out and go bird watching and they report what they see to this centralized database called eBird. And through the data sets that are created by this, you know, people respond, you know, I saw 20 palm warblers and I saw 5 cardinals and I saw 6 white ibis. And through that, you can actually watch where bird populations move across the map. That data set creates a really, you know, in-depth understanding of how birds are using the landscape and what they're doing when. You know, because, you know, when you see a bird fly over the horizon, they don't tell you where they're going. So this kind of, you know, creates this continuum of information about them.
What are the sort of birds that we could see right now that are migrating?
Well, the biggest one everyone's seeing right now in their yards are these things called American redstarts. And they're a species of warbler, which is a type of songbird. And they're about the size of your thumb. And the males are black with these orange spots in the tail. And the females are kind of olive with these yellow spots in their tail. And they tend to flit around on the ground and spin around a lot. Basically, they're trying to chase bugs. They're trying to fuel up for the rest of their migration. But a lot of these birds came down in the last week with the storms we've been having. You know, everyone in Key West is seeing them. I'm pretty sure everyone on the mainland is seeing them. But that's probably the most plentiful species of birds. And then there's probably another 20 species of warblers and another 20 species of songbirds you could be seeing migrating right now.
Do you have a moment, you know, in your whole life that you've been, in all the time you've been doing this, where it's like, wow, that was like a great moment. You saw something or experienced something that has never been duplicated.
Well, I mean, I've seen a couple rare birds. Like, I was one of the people who found this thing called a Stygian owl. Never been seen in Florida before. I'd been seen twice in Texas for one day each. They're in Cuba, but they're never even easy to find there. And then there was one day in somebody's front yard over behind City Hall down here. And that's probably the rarest bird I've ever found. But, you know, there's all these moments. I mean, you go out and you just start birding, you start paying attention to that, and you start letting the rest of your problems kind of fall away. It's kind of a form of meditation, which is nice. And it's a connection. You kind of realize the world is a bigger place than you think it is, which is always a good thing to be reminded of.
That is Mark Hedden, Executive Director of the Florida Keys Audubon Society. You can learn more about some of the birds migrating now in our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, May 21st. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington. Sherilyn Cabrera is our fill-in associate producer. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, coming up next week on the program, how is South Florida's economy going to recover from the coronavirus pandemic? We're going to talk with the president of a human resources group who will explain our economy will recover, but it's going to look a lot different in the next 6 to 12 months. Plus, the Monroe County School Superintendent will join us, so we'll get to hear from folks in the Keys. And if you have questions for him, you can go ahead and post those on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We're not going to have a program on Memorial Day, so for those of you off, enjoy the 3-day weekend. Hopefully the weather is good. Be safe. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend, a great holiday. We'll talk to you again live on Tuesday.